Hey everyone, this is Jordan Van Trump, and thanks for tuning in to another episode of How I Built This Ag Business. Just wanted to let everyone know this podcast is sponsored by the company I started right out of college called AgSwag. I'm sure like many of the other disruptors on this podcast, I started this company searching for cooler stuff and better service. One of my first tasks when I got out of college was finding some cool hats for my dad's business, as my family and their friends always struggled to source quality swag throughout the years. I started this company only making a few hats, and have been fortunate enough to meet some of the top business leaders in the ag industry along the way. I've worked with some of the biggest disruptors currently in the space, such as FBN, Benson Hill, Pivot Bio, Pattern Ag, Holganics, as well as many veterans such as Cargill, Nutrien, Dairy Farmers of America, Kent Corp, CGB, Helena, and the list goes on and on. Throughout this journey of providing swag to various companies in agriculture, I've had the opportunity to learn some of the best business lessons, hacks, marketing strategies, and many other things to take my company to scale and become more successful throughout the years. My intentions of this series is to bring on guests that I've had the opportunity to work with over the years to tell their story and hopefully help you build your business in the future. Hope you enjoy. Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of How I Built This Ag Business. We got Bruce Howlett and Michael Howlett on here today with Howlett Farms, which is a fifth generation family-owned agriculture business that started in 1880. With two dairy cows and 13 acres. Today, they farm over 3,700 acres, have over 50 employees. Besides farming, they also operate 7 grain handling facilities that handle over about 20 million bushels of grain annually. They manufacture feed for the dairy and livestock industry, run a fleet of over 25 trucks, and also have an insurance business called Clover Agrisk Management. With that, I'd like to welcome you guys to the show.
Thanks for having us. Appreciate it.
Yeah, yeah, I guess we'll get started with how this little farm began back in 1880. Is that your grandpa, Bruce, that started that?
Actually, it would be my great-grandpa, and he started in 1880, and then my grandpa Jasper came along, and he bought it out from my great-grandpa, and again, pretty small. On land today that is being developed heavily, where the original home farm was, and not very good soils, so they didn't farm a lot of acres, really heavy soil, pasture cattle, more just stayed in business type thing. To move forward with that a little bit, then my dad and his brother started growing the business with the demand for vegetables, kind of in the Northeast with our lakes and clouds and not extreme heat. The vegetable industry, apples, grapes, green beans, sweet corn, all that stuff started taking off. And my dad was 5 years younger than my uncle, but my dad was a very driven individual and, by the time I was old enough, I realized he ran the farm, you know, and as I started working on the farm, my grandpa, I never really knew. He was more on the sideline by the time because my dad was so dominant that he really wasn't leading the farm. So he had given the farm over to the leadership of my dad. And I think that's what Michael and I talk about lots of times is what we think is so important today is that you have to, you know, hand the torch off to the next generation. So when I was young, my dad all of a sudden came to me and said, okay, you're making the decisions now. I was about 30, 32. And I said, no, I'm not, you know, I'm not going to do that. But it makes a big difference of when in your life you start making decisions that impact the farm. So kind of like Michael, my dad let me grow. So in the early 80s, ag had all those issues. So I was out of college in the mid 80s, opportunity to buy a lot of land. And we did, and my dad did, and large blocks of it. And we kept expanding from there. We had a potato farm that we did get rid of the potato farm, which I kind of look back at, that would have been fun. But we got into more of the vegetables, sweet corn, peas, green beans, heavier custom harvesting. And probably the next thing that we changed was Agway. I don't know if you guys are much familiar with Agway, but they were dominant fertilizer, commodity business in the Northeast. They were all the way from Maryland, New England, and over here. They went bankrupt in about 1995, and that's how we evolved into the grain business. We had relationships with dairy farmers that said, "What do we do with our extra corn?" They typically plant 20% more corn than they need in case of the drought. And that same year, they came and said, "We got all this corn. What do we do with it? We can't go to Agway with it." So that was the start of our grain business, and we got a few bins since then. But yeah.
So we raised a lot of vegetables through the 90s, and then there was a lot of consolidation in that vegetable business. We were one of the top growers, but as they started consolidating at a corporate level, they became much more picky. We had very they had all the buying power, and so we didn't have the negotiating seat at the table, and that's when you made the decision, hey, we want to be in control of our own destiny, and started focusing more on corn, soybeans, and wheat. And so we shifted a lot of our acres away from snap beans and peas and other field crops like that over to corn, beans, and wheat.
Yeah, we dropped green beans. We were a custom operator, and we had about 1,000 acres, and we dropped them. They knew we were getting out, so we mutually kind of terminated a relationship with them, and we went into 1,000 acres of red kidney beans the next year. We had a little bit of red kidney beans, but that wasn't a good move. That was that to harvest red kidney beans at 1,000 acres, and again, our cloudy, wetter type environment, and we kind of downsized that pretty quick and went more into soybeans and corn. So I had a background in grain marketing. That's what I took in college. And so that when the opportunity, when Agway came forward, one of the reasons we stopped the vegetables is I kept going, "Wait a minute here, we can get way higher prices if I hedge it and forward contract it than what they were going to lock us in at." They would lock us in at harvest type prices for grain. And so if we could price it out and do different, it didn't make any sense. So that's kind of how we started looking at it. And they started cutting costs. They started having trouble. We dealt with Seneca Foods a lot. You know, it was a tough time for them. And they started cutting custom rates, trucking rates, things like that. So we kind of moved out.
So where are you guys, where most of your acres at?
We're just south of Rochester, Rochester, New York. We're just south of Rochester. We're right in the snow belt, and you know where our original farm was Kodak land. So Kodak was started back in 1880, partnership between Henry Strong and George Eastman. So same year that it would be my great-great-great-grandfather started farming, Kodak started. And we ended up, some of the land that our original homestead was on back in 1880 was a big Kodak park. And you know, we all know what happened with Kodak. And actually that was kind of a very definitive thing in my life, seeing what Kodak did. You know, I think you think back to how prevalent it was when I was growing up, and in 1999, Kodak posted $2.5 billion in profits. Between 2004 and 2007, they laid off 50,000 people.
Damn.
And in Rochester, everybody worked for Kodak.
60,000.
Yeah. I mean, it was unreal. Everybody had it. So all of a sudden, all of these people were losing their jobs, and they didn't know what to do. And you rewind and look back at what Kodak did, and that has shaped our business, because Kodak invented a handheld digital camera in 1975. In 1979, one of their key strategists said that by 2010, all film will be digital. But the higher ups at Kodak said change is unnecessary, because they had such a stranglehold on the market. Nobody else was producing any film. But then in the 1990s, here comes Fujifilm. And Kodak was behind the eight ball. They thought change was unnecessary. And so they did not have the means to catch up to Fujifilm and declare bankruptcy in 2012. And that happened right in our backyard. We used to work that ground. And then, you know, the Kodak Park that was always bustling went vacant, and, you know, we watched it rot before our eyes. A company that in 1999 had $2.5 billion in profits. So, you know, it's pretty, that was formative to us in the need to be able to remain agile and respond to change, respond to the markets. When we look at agriculture, we've done it all. Our family, from when we started farming, we've hit every aspect of agriculture: dairy farming, potato farming, vegetables, beef cattle, grain handling, and what we pride ourselves on is remaining agile. And, you know, my dad and I make all the decisions. And when we see something, or we don't like something, or we want to attack something, we look at it and we can go get it. And we can make the moves, and we can talk through it and say, hey, how are we going to do this? Or how are we going to respond to this? When you see the consolidation with Bird's Eye Foods or whatever it may be, and how we go after it. I graduated high school in 2006, and that's when all of that was going down at Kodak. So, it was pretty formative for us to see that.
We got committed to diversifying ourselves too. We knew long term to be viable in our area, there isn't massive size fields. We're smaller size fields. You know, we can't go buy 1,000-acre blocks very easy and really grow the farm. And so we looked at diversifying ourselves, and that's, you know, currently we have a trucking outfit. We have the grain bins and storage, and we have the farm. So one thing's not good, something else can help pay the way.
Yeah. So tell me the story on how you guys got into the grain handling business. Like,
so
Fred Agway went bank. Is that kind of how it started? But I guess how'd you guys get pinned into that craziness?
Yeah, craziness is one word for it. So to illustrate the craziness and a little bit of scope, so yesterday was our first big day of wheat harvest, early for us here. One of our guys, we were out combining, and one of our farm crew guys calls us and says, hey, I know it's late, but I was out running the dryer. He said, can I come unload? And I said, please do come unload, because for all of our facilities handled, you'd be truck number 250. So we handled through our own facilities yesterday 250 trucks. That does not include our direct ship model, which would probably add about another 100. So scope of things, you know, we moved about 350 loads of grain, feed, and ingredients yesterday. So backing up to the start of the craziness, when we bought the 1,000 acres, you bought that?
88.
That was the year I was born. So talk about taking it all on at once. Bought 1,000 acres of farmland, and then we started building some grain bins about 10 years later, right?
95, 97.
Yeah, and built a facility here that was going to be for all the storage our farm would ever need, wouldn't ever need anything beyond that. Well, what happened when Agway started to go down in the late 90s, we started to see a pickup in business. Agway declared bankruptcy in 2002. And so all of a sudden, the dairy farms that had been shipping their corn into Agway and then getting feed back, they had nowhere to go. So they would bring their wet corn to us. We would dry it for them, store it for them, and then we would ship it out to a cornmeal grinder, one of several facilities, and they would take it back as feed. So we were handling that in the real early 2000s. We were doing that, and word got out that we would crank trucks through. You know, we looked at it like how a farmer would want to run a facility. We know we want to get our trucks back to the field so we can keep combining. So we built extra dump pits. We made extra storage. We put in a big dryer. So as the trucks kept rolling through, we kept getting more and more business. And then what ended up happening was with some of the dairy farms, they would have extra bushels that they wouldn't need to take back as feed. And other farmers would bring them in. Some of our neighbor farmers would bring them in, and we kind of would take bigger blocks of bushels. We would take some of our farm bushels as well as some other customer bushels that were bringing them in and say, hey, we're going to sell 10,000 bushels to the dog food plant. Do you want to add in 5,000 that you got here, and this guy add in another 5,000 that he has here, and this guy adds in 10? Next thing you know, instead of selling in a 5,000 block, we've got more negotiating power because we're selling in a 50,000 bushel block. And we could kind of play with, you know, we would sell some of the farm's grain, and then if we priced it at a good level, or we wanted to, instead of buying a call option, we could switch another farm in there. So we were playing with that a little bit in the early 2000s. And then it just continued to grow. When I went out to the University of Illinois, and you know, I was getting ready to come back. I think I was a junior or something, and my dad and I were kind of talking like, what are you gonna do on the farm? I had tried farming for 10 years between ages 8 and 18. And I stunk at it. I mean, we had to have a full-time crew, someone ready to pull me out, fix what I was breaking. I was bending drawbars because I was turning too short. I mean, it was just nuts. I did not have the attention span to do it. So we knew I wasn't going to come back to the farm as an operator. And we kind of talked about it, like, well, you can dispatch some of the trucks that we're running. And we said, well, what do we really need? And that's where we realized the potential that was there for our grain facility to do a full-fledged merchandising program, learn to trade futures, learn to trade options. And that's how, you know, we can maximize what we're doing with our grain facility here. So I went to a few different places. I went to CGB. Talked to them there, and I tried to get a job. They didn't want me. I tried to get into the schooler program. They didn't want me there. Then I was at a conference, and I heard a guy named Mark Bold speak. And I walked up to him after the conference, and I said, hey, I'm kind of interested in what you're talking about here. I like the idea of futures and options. And he said, sure, kid, pass your series 3 and come see me and you got a job. So that was 2010, about the time you were starting Farm Direction with Andy around then. So I worked in Mark Gold's office at 100 South Wacker, shared the office with Daniels Trading and Global Asset Advisors. And that's where I learned to the mechanics of trading futures, how to offset risk, and how to really understand how the market moves and what we need to do to protect ourselves against volatility. So, you know, Mark Gold, Andy Dugan, and Glenn Swanson, and Ken Packard, and all those guys, I was working with them getting a schooling on what the commodity markets were. So I did that for 3 years, and waited for the December put options to go off in 2012, and once those went off, I cashed in and came back in January, and then that's where we took the model and started expanding it.
I think you might be on mute.
Yeah, that's that old thing again kicking in. Now you guys offering all kinds of different strategies, different products to your people that deliver, and different ways to hedge their risk.
Yeah, and when I was at Top Third, you know, I think we were looking at going to get some bigger guys. We were looking at the big producers, and I was working with guys raising cotton and rice and cattle and all sorts of different things, but we were really focused on the bigger producers. New York is a smaller market. There aren't the mega producers with 25,000 acres or 30,000 acres. It's just a different, more fractured marketplace. And it's untapped. A lot of people, they're not going to set up a brokerage house and try and go after the New York farmers. So I wanted to bring the tools back that some of these bigger guys in Iowa and Indiana and Illinois that they were utilizing. You know, contracts are 5,000 bushels. Anybody raises 5,000 bushels. So why can't we do some of these different contracts with some of the smaller farmers? And that's what we did. And we looked at the landscape. When I was in Chicago, I would be talking to a lot of the guys, and they'd be like, "Oh, my grain elevator, they got me again. They talked me into selling." And it was a very adversarial, confrontational relationship. And that's how it was back in New York too. You know, there was a lot of the resellers and a lot of the brokers that they didn't work with the farmers. It was always this push and pull. So when we wanted to get into it, we looked at it as, we're farmers. We understand the struggles and the challenges that come at farms every single day. Why create another problem when they're trying to sell their grain and get paid for all the work that they put in? Let's make it more of a partnership. Let's make it so we work together. And we were very cognizant of the fact that we had been here for five generations reliant on agriculture. And if farming failed in Western New York, there was no reason for us to be here. And that would be the end of our legacy, is if farming failed. So we looked at it and said, how can we push agriculture forward in Western New York, in the Northeast, to make sure that we succeed as a unit and agriculture continues to grow? So that was kind of where we took it, and it's been a great success.
The dairy business is the mainstay around here now, and it's continuing to grow, and they definitely needed help in protecting themselves in their feed and their wheat. That they all, a lot of them all raise wheat for the straw, whatever. So we first hit the small farmers, educated them. And in the last 5 years, we've really been concentrating on the dairy guys, and we've got into the feed business more. But that is our goal, is what Michael's saying, is if they're making money, we're making money, everybody's happy, and it's not an easy business. And so we're there to help each other. And it was kind of, when Michael came back, at first it was going to be dispatch, but then he got right into the grain marketing. I remember telling somebody, man, this is going to take a long time for all my customers, but I pretty much handled all the customers at that time, people, the producers we bought from, get to transfer it over to Michael. Well, that didn't take too long. About 2 years later, I was disappointed. All my customers were going over to Michael. And the reason I told Michael is, I said, a farmer needs to relate to a farmer. And his background was in farming, and so people accepted and they quickly trusted them. And I think that's where we are. Money's a big thing. We pay people on time, paid them. We used to even pay people early. We don't do that anymore, but we used to pay them early if they needed the money, but we got too big to do that anymore. Once people trust you, they'll sell you their bushels and you help them out of a bind, and it works good. But the dairy business in Western New York is starting to elevate, and it's only going anywhere is up in volume. Yeah.
Michael, with your time at Top Third and your time there at the elevator, what do you think's because you know, a lot of people are still sitting on old crop. Hell, what do they say? I think the numbers yesterday said maybe people have 10% of new crop price on average across the U.S. It's like, what do you, you know, it's going to be painful. You know, there's no question, but what do you think
The problem is the old crop that's still sitting on the farm. People can't get, they can't wrap their head around selling new crop when they've got so much old crop yet to sell. And, you know, I'll take words right out of your mouth from FarmCon. You got to put a stake in the ground and manage around it. You got to do something. The guys that are just, you know, closing their eyes, putting their head in the sand, it just gets ugly, because then when they need cash, they're just letting it rip, and that's the worst thing you can do, because it's immediate ship. It's an opportunity cost for someone that's buying it, that's trying to ship contract. But you know, just going out there and doing something, put yourself in some sort of win-win situation. I don't think, you know, there's many win-win situations with the prices where they're at, but if you can sell something and the market goes up, you only got 10% sold, and guess what? Good thing you sold some, and the market goes higher, you got a lot more to sell. If you sell some and the market goes down, well, good thing you sold something. So yeah. you gotta look at where we can do something. But I think around here, it's gonna be a tough next 6 months. There's a lot of old crop wheat sitting around. The millers volume is just way, way down. Carries are good, but it's still going to be a space issue to be able to get everything in, and yields, they look good. I think this hurricane coming through, Hurricane Beryl, I think that's going to help the Midwest farmers. Any region that had a slight drought issue, either abnormally dry or even less, that's going to get hit by Beryl, and that's going to basically be a drought buster on any hope that we had. You look at the drought monitor, and there's no areas that are critical. I don't know how long I've looked at that it's just clear in the major crop growing areas. It's a little scary. Demand to me seems like the issue. The American farmer is very, very good at raising a crop. Where that supply does not drive the markets long term. What drives long, solid rallies is demand, and that's what we need. We need demand to come from somewhere. I was looking at it a while ago, you know, looking at the big rallies that we've seen, and if you look at it, peak to trough on the way down from the first time to the way up. Halfway back to the way up on the next time. You know, how long are we going to hang out in the trough? The scary thing is the shortest time period that we've had that low period was 19 months. And I guess we're probably 5 or 6 months into that low period now, but the shortest that we've seen from that halfway down to halfway up was 19 months, and the longest was over 10 years. So to think that the market is just gonna bottom out here and then cure for low prices is low prices and right back up to $6 we go, I think that's a long shot. I do think that cycles are continuing to get shorter because it is a very volatile world with a lot of uncertainty, but I think it's hard to claim that we're not going to do some bottom washing for a while. What do you think, Kevin?
Yeah, no, I would agree with you for sure. I mean, I think, you know, that's probably where we're headed. And we tried to be aggressive and sell ahead early on a lot of things. We were real aggressive with wheat and corn. Obviously, looking back, wish we would have done even more. But, you know, at the time, people were like, I wonder if I'd lost my mind. But shit, now I'm like, man, I wish I would even price more. But, you know, it is what it is at this point. So. Yeah, I'm with you. It's scary to think how long the cycles last. I think a lot's going to hinge on, you know, how this election plays out, how whatever moves forward with China and our administration. And, you know, are they going to, you know, try and play some games? And it looks that way. I mean, they're not buying any beans. They're not doing anything with much with corn and tapering things back. So, yeah, like you said, demand could be a little iffy. And that's kind of scary when you're plus 2 billion bushel on corn and you know, looking at 500 on beans. So demand definitely has to kick in at some point, which hopefully sooner than later, right? If prices continue.
Right.
Yeah. So, yeah, crazy.
And the hardest thing to do is to market in a falling market. To sell grain in a falling market, so hard to do it. You know, we have farmers that place a lot of targets, and it's really effective when you're in a flat market or a rallying market. Target prices are great. In a falling market, you put one that's 10 cents above the market, and you go 5 trading days, and you're 40 cents below the market. Now what? You know, and they say, wow, I just should have sold it. And the coulda, shoulda, woulda becomes paralysis when it just keeps going down. It's trying to catch the falling knife, and it's brutal. It's so hard.
Yeah, no, I agree for sure. So were you guys in a construction business at one point out there? Do I remember that?
Yeah, because we have some land that's north of us in that Kodak area and stuff. So we did have Ryan Homes, which is a national company, come to us and say, they came in and they said, if you can run a business like that, we think you can manage building lots. So what you do is we start from scratch and we get the road in, the sewers in, you go through the towns, all the planning boards, get everything done. And then when it's completed with gas and telephone, everything, Ryan buys the lot from us. And it was a good experience for me. I'm still doing some of it. And it was a learning curve because it's a little different than agriculture. A little bit different. I think it's something I've learned is that I love agriculture and I'm never going to get out of it because the construction is more cutthroat. You know, we've done millions of contracts. We've only had a little bit of trouble with a few contracts with farmers. I'm not delivering the construction every day. It's somebody's trying to get you. So we're going to buy about 2 more years. We'll have done 350 housing lots. Each one's about 100. We got one completed. The second one's about 2 to sell. And we're just starting selling lots on another 110. But there's a lot to it. And it's just like any other business, but takes a lot of money up front. So the interest cost is a big one, change in that versus where we were. Ryan Homes doesn't pay you till you're 100% where they can build the house. And so it's kind of like farming, all that money up front, and then you sell your crop. And that's how I kind of liked it. But it was a good lesson for me. I'm not saying we're going to switch our business model, start doing all construction, that's for sure.
Is that the only business you guys have done outside of agriculture?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. I mean, trucking is 100% agriculture, you know. Associated with our trucks. We don't think we'd run a trucking company if it wasn't for the benefit of our customer service and things. Trucking is a tough business.
Let me rephrase that. We definitely wouldn't run a trucking company. So 99% of the loads that we haul are products that we own. So we've got, you know, now I think we've got closer to 30 trucks on the road every day. You know, we bought another trucking company a couple years ago after we bought one of the feed mills farther out east. And the trucks are tough, especially in an inflationary environment and a post-COVID world that we're going to live in forever, where parts are just not available. And it's a very, very tough business. So, you know, I a little bit bipolar on the subject. Every about 2 weeks, I swing from we need to sell all of our trucks to we need to buy more trucks. And it's all about customer service, being able to deliver feed just in time. A dairy farmer doesn't want his feed 3 days early, and he certainly doesn't want it 3 days late. A farmer, if they call up, say, hey, I got a bill to pay on Friday. Can you get 16 loads pulled out of us in the next 2-3 days? Yes, we can. We turn our trucks. We go get it. We move it. He comes and picks up a check. So it gives us flexibility and agility in our business to be able to direct resources and move what needs to be moved to where. And that's so if a customer, ethanol plant unit train doesn't show up and they need bunch of loads of corn to keep the plant running, we're their first call because we can say, yep, we will point every single one of our trucks at you. And in the next 2.5 days, we can deliver 100 loads of corn to you. And that is one of our competitive advantages. It's certainly not the most rosy line on our income statement, but it allows our other businesses to succeed.
Did you start the trucking business as a service for your other businesses, or did you kind of pivot into that model?
Well, when we just had the grain elevator, we were building the bins and we were shipping stuff out. We were sending stuff to an ethanol plant that had partnered with a garbage hauling company out of Syracuse. And so these guys would come in to load corn, and they would have those huge garbage hauling trailers, and they would fill them up, tandem axle trailer, and they'd have 130,000 on, pull across the scale and go, whoa, I can't haul this, and pull them around and dump it off. They'd be spilling grain,
Spelling grain.
and we're like, we cannot do this. And if we're going to send these trucks to some of our customers, that's our name on the contract. We're responsible for that equipment and that driver and the mess they made going into this individual's farm. And we looked at it and just said, we ain't doing this. So we ended up getting a couple of our own trucks, and it's continued to expand from there.
Yeah, all about customer service. When we first started, we were mostly all rail, rail up into New England. So our basis was lower. We were able to work it out. So we did a ton of rail. So we didn't have to have the trucks, and a lot of it was delivered to us. However, we have an ethanol plant now within 50 miles of us, and we had a second one within 110. So now our basis was too strong to ship up to New England, and they started going other places where there was lower basis. So we had to get trucks. We had to start going to these. I think one of the things we learned big time, always have, is you can't burn your bridges with your customers because one day you don't think you need somebody, but 2 years later you need them. So like the ethanol plant, they're tough, but we ship a lot of bushels in from them.
Yeah, Jordan's asking you. Hey, Jordan's asking that because he's always trying to, last year or two, trying to wrangle me into the trucking business. And it's just gotten a shit kicked out of it down here. A lot of guys as of late. And Jordan's like, we ought to get in there now, step in and buy some. And I'm just like, man, I have heard so many. I've heard good stories, but boy, I hear horror stories. It's like you're
What's
saying.
going to kill? What kills the trucking business is the insurance.
Oh,
It
yeah.
continues to go up,
Crazy.
especially over the road trucks. I was talking to another guy, another dairy farmer, and he had a trucking business, and he said, I got to 9 over the road trucks. We're looking to expand our trucking model, and the insurance was $400,000 for those 9 trucks.
Yeah,
And he's
my
like,
cousin sells. Yeah, my cousin sells for Marsh, so they do all big insurance down here. Shit, my God, some of these guys' policies are crazy. Yeah, like you said, running over the road, and they all bitch about it, running over the road into New York or California. It's like insurance just out of sight, and the regulations, craziness. So, I'm steering clear, I think.
Sorry, Jordan.
I guess getting the trucking insurance business.
There you go.
Maybe, yeah. Who knows? So,
No. How'd you guys get started on the origination side of things? Like, what was your first deal on that end, and how'd you continue to blaze down that path? Like, 'cause you guys have, like, I think I read you have over like 50 different people that buy your grain now.
we ship to probably 100 different end users. We've got like 5 or 6 traders in-house that buy grain and work directly with farmers and originate grain. How it started? Relationships.
Yeah, it's the dairy industry was struggling because they didn't know what to do with their bushels, and the word of mouth. I bought 99% of the corn for a long time. I never even called anybody. They all called us.
Yeah.
But we go back to that farmer thing. The conversation most of the time was about how did you farm this or how did you do that? It wasn't about what's the price of grain. At the end of the conversation, they'd say, what's the price of grain today, Bruce? And I'd say it, and they go, that's sell 10,000. So it was a relationship we developed. And I think that's especially big with a farmer, you know, when a farmer that has his life into it. People don't understand.
Yeah.
You know, you look at these farms around here, there's a lot of them. They never sell. They die with the same farm. You know, they're small farm. They just can't sell the farm. That's so important to them. The next generations are a little farther from that. But relationships, I would say, are more important in this than any business.
Yeah. And just through the custom work and being on different boards, you know, being you were on Farm Bureau boards, and so was I, just getting to know people and having a face to the name. You know, some of these cross-country traders that are, you know, it's tough. People don't know them. And someone walks in and says, hey, you want to buy my grain? And you look them in the eye, and you shake their hand, and or they see you out there at the dump pit, grading wheat, whatever, that builds that trust and that relationship. And yeah, it's a relationship business. Yeah. There's nothing about it. It's a relationship business.
It's money too. So in this area, when we started the business, it was 30, 60, 90 days before you'd get paid on like a cash contract. There wasn't a lot of forward contract. And so we always went to a dry bean guy, and I wasn't buying, I wasn't handling our sales at that time. That was at an early age. And he always would ask me, do you want your money when you leave? I go, I don't know if my dad wants to sell it or not, you know, but it always stuck with me. So I kept the same philosophy. So we paid people as soon as they wanted their money. So if they needed it within 15 days or, you know, we got to the point we pay them today, we pay them the day they come in, we can pay them, which a lot of companies do, but we were ahead of the game. That put trust out there because money is always something big with that. They know they have to have the money. They raise their crop, they have to have the money. And the banking has changed a little bit since we started, you know, like maybe 300,000 I could float for a month or two, and we're a little higher than that right now, you know, with margin calls and everything else. So, but I would get stressed out when somebody didn't pay me $300,000. I didn't know how I was going to get through the next month because of my loan agreements with the bank. Well, that's another real important one. Is that's what Michael's taken off with, is we got a great accounting department. We meet weekly. We go over everything. And if the bank has to have trust in you too. That's another place the bank has to have trust in you.
Yeah.
Are you guys just originating corn, beans, and wheat? Or are you getting into like other things that you guys don't like actually handle and grow?
Yeah, so we originate a lot of feed ingredients as well for the dairy farm. So soy meal, chocolate feed, cotton seed, soy plus, amino plus, you know, a lot of different feed ingredients. But generally, just the bulk commodities, easy stuff. We like going big, going fast. You know, delivering. We don't mess with a lot of the micro ingredients for the dairy diet. But we do probably 15 different commodities that we buy and sell, merchandise.
So Michael, you got kids? You guys have?
Yeah, I got three. Yeah, got three kids. Got two boys and a little girl. 5'3", and the little girl's about to turn two. So we're busy.
You guys are, for sure. So what are you trying to grow? What side of the business are you trying to grow the most? The grain origination, the farm side?
So we've been in a period for the last 20 years or so of excessive growth. And it's not because we said, this is what we want to grow and push towards that. We've been growing because it's been organic growth. It comes from doing the right thing, helping people, and then earning more of their business. I guess I look at it that we bought probably five different agricultural companies in the last 6 years. And none of them have been, hey, we're going after this business. We want to expand our footprint, or we want to do something different. It's been an elbows out approach. You know, something comes up and we say, hey, in order to maintain our position in the marketplace, preserve our future. We need to go elbows out, and we need to make sure we can defend ourselves. And so, you know, it's not an imperialistic, you know, we're expanding and trying to grow and pushing our footprint to take over. It's been, how do we stay viable and make sure that we can continue to add value to the agricultural supply chain? How can we leverage the resources that we already have to execute on synergies and make things work better? So right now, a few people have asked me this, is what's next? And it's like, I want to hone in what we're doing now. There's a lot of change in technology right now. We're on the cusp of a real agricultural revolution with a lot of different aspects. And so I'm not looking for the next big thing. I'm looking at what we're doing now and how we can elevate that to become more efficient, more effective, more utilize what we have instead of trying to just get bigger for being the sake of getting bigger. 2 weeks from now, something comes up, we might say, heck yeah, let's take a look at this. And there we go. We're off to the races again. But we don't approach our business like that. We're not saying, okay, what's the next acquisition target? A lot of them come to us.
Yeah. Most of them come to us.
Yeah.
And then it fits in. One thing I was thinking about our business is that I think it's important for other business people to look at is when I came back to the farm, my dad let me grow.
Yeah.
And he didn't hunker down and not let me make decisions. So I grew the farm and we grew all this stuff. And then I kind of slowed down a little bit too. Michael comes back. I think he needed the opportunity to take ownership on this growth. And we did growth that he owns. And he feels like he's required to make sure that he owns that. It's only part of the whole thing. But he wasn't part of my growth. He saw it happen. But I really think that for somebody to really be full in, they got to be part of the growth. And I told him the next generation is going to grow again. You know.
And even in your newsletter this morning, Kevin, it said, you know, that a tiny percent of farmers are 35 and younger, and even smaller under 30. And the rebuttal to it, someone made the comment that, yeah, it's because grandpa or dad won't give up any of the decision making until they're 90. Right. And that's it. I mean, that stifles the growth. And when I came back, he basically said, yeah, let's run. Let's go. I'm there to support you. Whatever you want, let's go. But let's do this. And when he was 30, that's what my grandfather did to him. That's when he bought 1,000 acres. And grandpa said, yeah, sure, go ahead. Go ahead and let's go. But this is on you. And you know, that passion and that fire, and that's how we're wired. I'm like, let's go, baby. Here we go. Get out and run. And I watched my dad all my life growing up, and he was always running. You know, he would be out running the combine till late at night. He would run the combine, then get out of the combine, come take us to basketball practice, coach us at basketball practice, come back, have dinner, and then he would go out and dry corn all night. And so to have that instilled in me, to always be running, whatever you're doing, just hustle. Hustling covers up a lot of mistakes, but if you're hustling, you can find your way to the finish line. You know, that was very formative for me.
Yeah, that's good info there, Jordan.
Yeah,
I mean, sure. How many times you heard that in your life? legs feed the wolf. Hustle everywhere you go. No, I agree. Two things on that, though, I will say, because we've been, am I frozen here?
Yeah, we can hear you, though.
Oh, good. Two things, because we've been working on ourselves. We always talk about a good business having to widen the moat, you know. The moat's either narrowing or widening, like we talked about at FarmCon. And you can widen the moat by acquisitions and other things like you guys have, but I thought it was interesting. Jordan and I have been working like you guys as of late. We've had some big time growth on the ag swag side and some other. Now we're trying to refine the processes, and you can widen the moat by doing that. Like you guys are saying, you know, just simplifying is hard as hell. You know, you think like I can simplify that. Oh, that should be easy. No, simplifying is very difficult, and Jordan's finding that out, and we all are, to simplify our processes down and make it easier, because then it becomes easier to add new people, add people on board, you know, and just everything becomes better if you can get those processes simplified. So, you know, I think those are two big, big points that you made right there. So glad to hear you guys doing it.
Yeah. Well, tell me this, why on the business acquisition side, why did you guys kind of go down the path of acquiring existing businesses rather than just starting your own? It's kind of been a thing we've been tossing around on our end too. Like, hey, like we're looking into maybe getting into a few other businesses. Like, should we acquire the business, like an existing one, or should we just go?
We've done both.
Own and how?
That's a good question. That's a good question.
So we've done both. You know, it's a good saying, why build it when you can buy it? And I think our first acquisition, this one was more of, we're seeing a change in the marketplace. How are we going to handle this? It was an ethanol plant that was out east. And it wasn't, we knew something was going on. I worked pretty closely with the C-suite there and something was up. And we knew the ethanol industry was kind of going through its ebbs and flows. And I had one meeting with them, and I left there and drove 150 miles straight to the other ethanol plant and sold 2.5 million bushels to them because I was concerned that they weren't going to be around. So I think I was sitting in the killing time in the hospital with our firstborn, thinking a little bit, and we said, well, we started working with all these farmers out east. We won't be able to buy their grain anymore if we've got to pull it all the way back west. So why don't we look at an opportunity to establish ourselves with our own facility that uses corn, so it's not just a black hole out east. So we could have built something, but as you throw on the competition onto a map and throw some radiuses on there and who you're going to be keep competing with, if you build something new, where do you build it? Most of the good areas are already built up because agriculture doesn't change that much in a few years. So we said, well, why don't we look at acquiring a facility that's already running rather than making it a more crowded marketplace and having to cut margins to be competitive and make an impact. So that was one of our main reasons that we didn't want to just go out and build something in a new market, especially because when we took over that business, we took over goodwill. We took over some customers that they had that are so used to coming, and they just continued on. We knew if we took care of them, they would keep rolling in. Sure, we lost some customers too, but we were able to keep a lot of those customers. And then you're not starting from scratch on the customer side. You've got a little bit of a base that you can build off of.
Was it similar on the feed side when you guys, what was it, Pat O'Brien feed you bought?
Yeah, that was the feed side. That was the one I was talking about out east. And we kind of approached that one like, hey, we're good in the grain business. You know, we understand this. We get it. Feed business will be pretty easy. And boy, oh boy, feed business is a different beast. It was a rude awakening. We took that over and I knew nothing. And that became very clear very quickly that I needed an education. And I got it quick. And then we were able to acquire two more feed processing facilities, kind of over long-term relationships. Two of the facilities that when we started taking corn from the dairy farms and drying it, and they would take it back to be ground, you know, it would go to those two facilities that we ended up buying 20 years later. And it just made sense to consolidate that supply chain, because instead of us buying it or us taking it in and taking a margin and then trucking it and the truckers getting a margin and then going to get ground and the grinder getting a margin, we can shrink our margin down so that at the end of it, after that whole chain, we have a big enough margin, but no one can operate on that small sliver of a margin in each segment. But, you know, to put it all together, we can operate it. And we take a small margin. We're in the commodity business. I got my MBA at the University of Rochester, and I got a kick out of it because the professors would say, when you're designing your new venture, stay away from any business that can be commoditized. Don't try and be anything that can. And I'm like, well, shoot, man, we are literally in the commodity business. And so we operate, it's high volume, low margin. We gotta go fast, we gotta go big, and we gotta make very, very few mistakes.
And do you centralize that from there? Like use your accounting team and guys do acquisition, or is it, yeah, you kind of bring in your sweet people, your accounting?
It's a lot of thinking. It's a lot of a gut feeling. Is it a cultural fit? Are there synergies? Right. You know, as you probably figured out from not being able to sit in the tractor, you know, I've got ADD, but one of the perks of ADD is you can get hyper focused on something. So if I get into something, I'll spend 6-7 hours just pouring over models and running sensitivity models and forecasting and seeing how can we make this work. And some of them you say, nope, can't make it work. And you know, I'll just sit in these like long several hour sessions just going through stuff. But at the end of the day, it's our finance team that says, yeah, we think this is a fit, and they'll try and poke holes in it and say, no, you're crazy on this, and this isn't going to work, or this is going to strain this side of the business. But really, it's just, you know, talking it through and getting on the whiteboard and drawing circles and lines and where this connects and where it could blow up. And
so one, I agree. And one thing we always talk about is that we, Michael and I, and as a business, we make long-term decisions, which isn't the same decisions a lot of other businesses make. They do something for the short term. So someone might look at our decision and it's we're buying this to take control of this, and it's not going to work maybe for a little bit here, but we're still going to do it because we think long-term is a good. So we think generational is a good way to put it, that we want to be generational, that we're out here every day protecting the previous generations and the new generations. Yep. And what our decisions are. It's not protecting Michael and me. We don't really care about us. We care about below us and above us.
Yeah, that's good philosophy for sure. I would agree. Jordan, what else you got?
That's about all I had on my end. Do you have any other questions for him?
Yeah, anything we haven't touched on or talked about that you guys wanted to talk about? Michael, you guys, anything?
No, I think it's just, it's all about passion. I think it's all about loving what you do and you know, finding what you're passionate about, and you'll be good at it if you're passionate about it. If it's that burning desire to get it right, and you'll spend the hours and you'll spend the effort to get it, and you're passionate about it, succeed at anything. And that's what everyone always says. Oh, don't work too hard, or you work too much, and hey, work. You know, this is life. We love this. You know, this is what we do. And you get tired and you get sore and exhausted, but that's the life. This is our life.
Yeah, I agree. That's us. Same thing. So I think anybody that, you know, didn't just get it off on a silver platter, I think you have to. I think you got to work. Right. You got to be out there, you know, constantly learning, making some things happen. So, yeah, I think we're all similar. The folks that, and the farm families that we have on the program, I'd say that's one big commonality. You know, everybody's hustling. Everybody's wife's saying you're working too much, or everybody, you know, it's just, you're not spending enough family time. It's just the same thing. But I don't know. I don't know how else you get ahead. Like you said, I mean, it's competitive out there. And I told Jordan, you got to outwork people, and you also got to be smart. So work hard and work smart, and try to make a go of it. So
yeah, if you ain't doing it,
hard to make a go of it, and man, it's easy to lose it. And you know, we've been at this for 144 years, and you know, four generations in front of me, and they made it, and you know, go at it every day like it ain't gonna be me. This thing's gonna work. It ain't gonna be me. We're gonna make this thing work one way or another.
And that is the pressure on a lot of farm families out there, don't you agree? I mean, yeah. Nobody wants to be the guy that runs the damn wheels off the wagon. I mean, it's like, so it makes it hard on the market. Like you're saying, it makes it tough to market, makes it tough to do a lot of things. You just don't want to make mistakes. And when you start getting in that mindset where you're more worried about the mistakes, you know, than just going for it, it things get tough, man. It gets difficult. So yeah. Question. So
is that why you think a lot of the older guys don't pass it down to the next generation, though, like we talked about earlier? Like just Bruce giving the reins over to Michael, like hell, he could have crashed the boat pretty easy.
Yeah,
I feel that you had to teach them. You know, I had a conference. I went to quite a few succession meetings, and one of them said, you know, not one of them, all of them basically said, you got to wear the business hat and then you wear the father hat. Well, I took this as really good, as if he wasn't qualified, don't give him the farmer's hat because he'll fail. And so you got to make sure that you teach him and you're doing everything. And if people don't have confidence in the person below them, if that's why they do it, I don't think so. I think sometimes it's hard to let go of what they've created. And I there's more to be created idea, you know, so.
Yeah, good. I don't know. That's a good question. I don't know. I think you're right. Yeah, it's emotional. It's an emotional attach. You've worked, you know, your whole life to build something, and all of a sudden this young kid that doesn't know nothing comes in, and how is he going to make a better decision than I can? Well, the only way he's going to make a better decision long term is to let him make those bad ones and learn from it, and you know, let him get the shit kicked out of him a couple times, and then he'll start picking it up and learning.
Here's the other thing. I'm not saying it was easy. When I was making 100% of the decisions after my dad left, it's hard to let somebody else make the decisions, but you have to. You don't have a choice. You have to watch. You're thinking to yourself, man, I did that four times and it failed four times, and I don't do that anymore. You watch somebody else make the same decision, but hey, you have to, you know? So.
Yeah, I always told Jordan my success when I was younger came from sports. So played four sports, got, you know, had different scholarships in every different sport. And I always look back and I struggled with business when I first got out of college and a couple of different jobs. I'm like, man, there is no way. I mean, I was great at sports and I kicked everyone's ass. It's like, how can I not do, you know? And like, you know, what was the difference? And it's like, I think there are two philosophies though. I think, and when I became good at sports, I looked back and I said, how did I get good at sports? And it's like, honestly, I just failed more times than everyone else, quicker than everyone else. So it's like, I just had balls and didn't give a shit and just went out, took a million swings and, you know, put myself in opportunities, failed more than anybody. And then I did have,
you got up every single time.
You got it. And then I did have some friends that, you know, they wanted to stay, they didn't want to go up to bat or didn't want to maybe be the guy that took the shot at the end of the game or, you know, just because they weren't ready yet. They didn't feel like, and that's what I've always said. I think it's a race. Like, you got a safe and you don't know the code to the safe. So it's like, the more times you can get in there and try and fail, shit, you got a chance to crack the thing. If you're going to just sit there and wait until you think you got the absolute combination, you know, I think that's the problem. And I think a lot of people are just afraid to let their kids fail because they want to do it. They don't want to put their kids in those positions. You know, they don't want to see them hurt or upset or wrong or, you know, and so they're kind of like, yeah, they protect them a little bit. And I think that spills over, Jordan. Like you said, I think people don't want to see the person, you know, maybe it's not so much that it's just a control freak, that the guy's 90 years old and he just wants to be in total control. Maybe just don't want to see his kids put in that position with all the pressure, all the problems and take on all the shit that they've had to take on. So, you know, they try to continue to be the first guy through the door, so to speak. You know, when you're raiding the house, you get bloodied up a little bit. So you kind of try to protect your kids. And And I've taken the approach, I just throw Jordan in the water. Like, the only way you're going to swim is to get in there and figure it out. I'm with you guys. You know, he does come out a little bloody and beaten up at times. But I did the same with my daughter. And I think those are, you know, I just think that helps people. It's like, oh, I always heard that, you know, that girl that created Spanx, her dad would have her come home and, you know, what would you fail at today rather than what'd you kick ass at today? And I think that's a great one. Hey, if you're not failing at anything, you're not trying new shit. So I think you definitely have to be taking some swings and taking some cuts. So I asked Jordan every day.
You take that, that's why it was at top third too, because I walked in there and they said, okay, here's your computer, your password, here's your login. Let us know if you have any questions. And I'm like, step one is like, just start cold calling. Here's a list of leads that were jumped from the other guys, but start calling. And it's like, okay, you know, you guys are walking in all these nice suits and I'm going to McDonald's dollar menu because I didn't have a penny to my name trying to figure out how to make a go at it. And I had to prove to myself that I wasn't just Howlett Farms, that I could get out and you know, spread my wings by myself too. And
I told him I'd pay his apartment in Chicago for 6 months, that he's on his own.
Yeah, I hear you. And that's a little bit of the issue with school, right? I mean, my daughter goes, gets a guy with a degree and all that. It's like, they teach you to follow directions and, you know, can you get your assignments in on time and, you know, not to make mistakes and not, you know, do things that are, they're going to be, and then you get out in the real world and it's like, you get a boss, you know, you go up there and Gold says, hey, figure it out and go get it. You're like, what the hell am I supposed to do? Nobody's telling me what to do. And it's like, yeah, no shit. Welcome to the real world. Nobody comes over to your guys' places in the morning and says, hey, here's what you're going to do today.
Yeah.
I agree. That's tricky. That's hard to do. So good stuff for sure. Jordan?
That's about it. Over. I appreciate you guys taking the time for the podcast.
Yeah, so for sure.
Should help a lot of people out.
No, I appreciate what you guys do. I mean, you, Main Street Journal, I call it, because you talk about what's happening on Main Street. And yeah, I love it. We read it every day. And
yeah.
We'll see you in Kansas City.
Yeah, you bet. Let us know if there's anything we can do to help you guys in the meantime. So tell everyone hello. Talk to you. All see right, ya.
We'll see you guys.
Thank you. Thank you.